Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The First Amendment guarantees the freedom to publish without prior government censorship. Freedom of the press. It is apparently a memo the Trump administration didn't get or is choosing to ignore. In just the first year of the second Trump era, the Pentagon has imposed restrictions that sharply limit how journalists gather information, leading nearly every major news outlet to surrender their Pentagon press credentials in protest. The White House removed the Associated Press from the briefing room for refusing to adopt Trump's new name for the Gulf of Mexico. Trump has frivolously sued major news outlets, including CBS, The New York Times, even the Des Moines Register, over coverage he disliked. Recently, in an unprecedented move, the Trump Justice Department conducted a raid of a Washington Post reporter's home, seizing her phone and her work and personal laptops. And since he first glided down the golden escalator at Trump Tower, Donald Trump has referred to the media as the enemy of the people, echoing authoritarians through time. It is one thing to try and control the narrative. It is another to clamp down on the truth, using the power of the government to do so. And this is just the first year of what appears to be an unbridled administration. What might the next three or the rest of our future hold? Today we take a closer look at what's been happening and at what may be ahead. Ida Alami is the James Madison Visiting Professor on First Amendment Issues at Columbia University School of Journalism. She joins us along with Philip Napoli, a professor of public policy and director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. And Trevor Timm is co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Trevor, I'm going to start with you as the co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. The list that I just went through scratches the surface. We're also experiencing an administration that regularly lies and asks citizens to disbelieve their own eyes. As a journalist, as the co-founder of that organization, how concerned are you and your fellow journalists about what we are going through?
We are very concerned. The list that you just went through would be disturbing to anybody who cares about the First Amendment. We have a president suing news organizations on a regular basis, which has, never happened in modern history. But the thing that I'm most concerned about is that it seems to be getting worse. And what I mean by that is that the raid of the reporter's home at the Washington Post that you just mentioned at the top, literally never happened, especially in the context of national security. So not only should the First Amendment protect journalists from having their home raided over who they're talking to, there is actually a specific law on the books called the Privacy Protection Act that was written explicitly to protect journalists from exactly what has happened. And so the Trump administration is either distorting or ignoring this law in order to go after journalists who was just doing their job. The other thing that happened just late last week was that they actually tried to prosecute the former CNN anchor Don Lemon, who was covering a protest in a church in Minnesota. And so not only did a judge reject that, but then they went to an appeals court to try to get them to overturn their rejection as well. Thankfully, that appeals court said no. But this is, I think this is the Rubicon that they may cross soon, actually prosecuting journalists for doing their job. And I think that's what I'm ultimately most worried about.
And to be clear about that Washington Post reporter, she has not been charged, nor was she going to be charged for anything. But they did seize her two computers, her personal and her work computer and her cell phone. And those could contain information about sources. That sends a chilling message to reporters everywhere, because your sources need to be protected or you can't report the truth because you can't get to it. You can attack the media verbally, Philip. You can even use the levers of power to attempt to control news outlets, as we are witnessing. But we do still have the First Amendment. Is that a sufficient backstop? Or can that only work if we have honest actors who are in charge of the top levers of government and who value American democracy, freedoms, and traditions.
It's a great question. And I think what we're seeing is that the First Amendment, unfortunately, can be, you know, also weaponized, because the flip side of this, in terms of, you know, these actions we're seeing taken against journalism and trying to suppress reporting, are the efforts to use the First Amendment to protect, you know, blatant disinformation and to suppress the work of folks who do disinformation research. You know, another news item from recent weeks has been the revoking of the visas from the folks in Europe who do fact-checking and disinformation research and things of that sort. We've had a ongoing congressional investigation into what's called the censorship industrial complex, under this notion that the very idea of disinformation is bogus, and that anything that platforms do or private speakers do to try to call out disinformation is actually an infringement on people's First Amendment rights. So it becomes this multi-pronged sort of assault that all points in this sort of same political direction.
It's upside down world. Ida, you've worked in other countries. You continue to work in other countries. You have seen and continue to see firsthand how press freedoms are handled in some of those countries. According to the World Press Freedom Index, the United States fell to 57th out of 180 countries, classifying us as having only a problematic press freedom environment, far below other advanced democracies in the world, and its lowest domestic ranking for this country ever. It warns of the cumulative effect of things being done by the Trump administrations, which may cause irreparable harm to our journalistic institutions. Do you agree with that? They say it would be difficult to repair some of these harms. Do you agree? And how does what you're witnessing here compare to what you've experienced in other countries?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm from Morocco, which is one of the most repressive places for journalists in the world. And actually, we rank better in Morocco only because journalists are not doing field work there anymore. But the repression is real, and the crackdown has been real. And one of the things I said early this year, so I've been writing for the Columbia Journalism Review about all these things that have happened this year with the Trump administration. And one of the things I said early on this year is that when the AP was banned from the press room and there wasn't an uprising from the rest of the press corp, that already set a precedent for what would come next. Because in Morocco, despite everything, despite the crackdown, despite journalists being routinely jailed on trumped up charges and everything, the press, the independent journalists really stand for each other and support each other. And I wrote a profile of the press secretary early this year, and it seemed very clear that everyone was negotiating their own access and everyone was kind of playing for their own field. And the other thing is the mass killing of journalists in Gaza was met with, you know, not that much pushback here or outrage. And I think similarly to what people are saying, how the violence produced by the U.S. abroad is now coming to the country, we're seeing that also. To see hundreds of journalists being killed without the industry having a big reckoning moment and a big kind of expressed outrage about it is ultimately going to impact the press here.
You've written a number of columns for the Columbia Journalism Review, and in one of them, you mentioned the atmosphere at the White House briefing room under Caroline Leavitt as being surreal, because she, like Sean Spicer and several of the press secretaries in the previous Trump administration who have come before her, seem to be able to articulate things that are blatantly false, and everybody in the room knows that they are blatantly false, and yet they stick to it. In that same article, you reference a number of journalists who have been killed covering conflicts around the world, and the tepid way in which the media industry has responded to those killings, though not equivalent. It seems that our own media industry has often taken a tepid roll over and play dead response, or roll over and cooperate response with some of the attacks being levied against it. How do you explain that?
That's a great question. I don't explain it, to be perfectly honest. I think there are many things going on. I think at the same time, we are losing the trust of the public in a way that makes us weaker. And we also need to be thinking about that, about how to regain trust from the public. We need the public to be standing with us in this moment. And yeah, I'm not so sure. I wish I had an answer about why the answer has been so tepid and not meeting the moment.
Some mainstream media outlets have acknowledged that we're losing the trust. Barry Weiss, just yesterday, who's the new person in charge of CBS News, referenced that in a staff meeting, that they have to regain the trust of people. And I think she was talking about mainstream media in general, but also CBS in particular, which has been attacked by the right for years, and which I think has added to whatever lack of trust may be real. But it seems, Trevor, that the public is way ahead of the media and other institutions in this country. Witness what's going on in Minneapolis. They are driving the change, not the press, not other institutions. Are we ahead of where journalism should be and where the people who run journalism outlets should be?
Well, certainly there's a trust problem with the media in the United States, and that is not just on the right. It's across the political spectrum. I think everybody within that political spectrum has different beefs with the media, so to speak. But I think that we also need to tell people on the right and Trump supporters or anybody who's listening right now who supports the Republican Party is that press freedom rights affect everybody. They affect you. They affect the news organizations that you listen to every day. And in fact, even though Donald Trump is right now the primary antagonist of press freedom rights, administrations from both parties for the last 20 to 25 years, essentially since 9/11, have been curtailing the rights of journalists, have been making the government more secret, have been making it harder to get documents out of the government, have been prosecuting whistleblowers at a record rate. And when we are saying that Donald Trump should not sue news organizations, that he should not raid reporters' houses, that he should not try to prosecute journalists, what we are also saying is that we should not be creating that precedent so that Democratic administrations or other Republican administrations can do that in the future too. And so I think when we talk about press freedom issues and journalists, there is this trust issue, and we have to acknowledge that it doesn't matter if you like Don Lemon or it doesn't matter if you like the Washington Post. We are protecting Don Lemon and the Washington Post in order to protect all other journalists, including the journalists that you like the most.
So, Philip, when you watch these news organizations rolling over and playing dead or paying major sums of money to the president because of frivolous lawsuits, would you describe that as a tepid response, or would you describe it as a cowardly response or an expedient response?
I would describe it maybe as a cynical response. The one thing I have to remember about, I mean, this is the unfortunate thing about how our entire news industry has evolved, that our, strongest, most, our news organizations that might be in the best position to resist are also part of large, diversified conglomerates with a variety of business interests. And that a lot of times the tepidness we see in the journalism space is a mechanism for buying favorable regulatory treatment in the antitrust space, for example. And so those that creates conflicts of interest, but but that is the nature of how our journalism industry has unfortunately evolved in this country.
And I want to talk about that because we're going through a series of these mergers and acquisitions, all of which have news components to them and which are probably the minor component of what they want to achieve as corporations. But nonetheless, they're in the crossfire. We'll do that when we come back, among other topics. We're here with Philip Napoli, professor of public policy and director of the DeWitt Wallace Center of Media and Democracy at Duke University, Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, and Ida Almy from the Columbia School of Journalism. It's Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about freedom of the press being under attack during part two of the Trump administration with Ida Alame with the Columbia School of Journalism, Philip Napoli with the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University, and Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. CBS and ABC have both settled what have been described as frivolous and baseless lawsuits filed against them by Donald Trump. Trevor, you spoke with James Goodall. I think that's how you say his name, Goodale or Goodall.
Yes.
Say it again.
Goodale, yes.
Goodale, a former vice chair and general counsel of the New York Times during the Nixon administration. And he told you that he believed at the time, and this is prior to the settlement, that if CBS in fact did settle, it would be disastrous for the press. Well, they settled. Trump has also threatened to pull the licenses of broadcast networks for broadcasting things he doesn't like. Of course, networks don't have licenses, but their owned and operated stations and their affiliate stations do. So these are legitimate threats. But are they that? Are they anything more than threats? Could these things actually happen? Are they merely a distraction or attempts to see if these organizations will actually bend the knee?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is they are threats, but they are threats that are working. You know, I think if you asked any First Amendment expert, no matter their political leanings, they could have taken a look at that CBS lawsuit and would have said 100 times out of 100, this is absolutely ridiculous. There's no way this would fly in a country that has a First Amendment, and a judge will throw this out at the first opportunity. I think the most depressing part actually about what has been happening with press freedom rights over the past year is not that Donald Trump is suing news organizations, which is of course horrible, but that many of the news organizations he is suing aren't even attempting to fight back. They are essentially bribing him with settlements in order to get regulatory favors for the giant conglomerates that own them. I mean, after the CBS lawsuit was settled for $16 million, 2 days later, the Trump administration approved the merger of Paramount and Skydance, Paramount being the 60 Minutes owner. And so, you know, I think that the good news is that the newspapers are fighting back. So the New York Times, even the Wall Street Journal. But it's really these networks that the FCC kind of lords over with these broadcast licenses that are really just rolling over to Trump administration threats. And the big problem is that, you know, as soon as Trump wins one of these lawsuits, or I say, quote unquote, wins, he doesn't actually win them. He gets people to essentially bribe him. He then turns around and does it to somebody else. So he settled with ABC. The next day, he sued the Des Moines Register. He settles with CBS. Now he's going after BBC. For him, it's a never-ending spigot of money until all of these news organizations collectively say, we're going to stand up and fight him.
Let me be clear about this. I don't think I've ever heard where this money goes. I don't think anybody's ever reported, at least not that I've heard, where this money goes that he's winning from these lawsuits. Does it go to him personally, or is it going into the coffers of the United States?
Well, it's not going into the coffers of the United States, and it is a good question. So for most of these lawsuits, and he has sued tech companies who have paid him off in the $25, $30, $40 million range as well. What the settlements end up saying is that it is going to the foundation or the organization that will support a future Trump library once he is left the presidency. But what I think a lot of people don't know is that there is nothing saying that they have to spend this money on any sort of library, that they can essentially do what they want with this money in any way possible, and there will probably be no transparency around it. So really, the money's going into a black hole.
Although during the campaign, Philip, in typical fashion, Donald Trump disavowed any knowledge of Project 2025, much of what his second administration has done and is trying to do is outlined in that document, and he's following it like a playbook, including his approach to the media. Many of his actions against journalists and news organizations come directly from Project 2025, from defunding public broadcasting to his unsuccessful attempt to end the Voice of America to decisions made about which outlets can accompany him as part of the official pool, giving White House access to so-called new media or friendly outlets that don't follow tested journalistic principles. All of that follows recommendations set forth in Project 2025. And their recommendation that traditional relationships with the media by the White House need to be, quote, re-examined. There is no question this is a different approach, but how do we know the difference between difference and dangerous?
Oh, gosh, I think dangerous is certainly the better fit here. We shouldn't forget, too, that the lead writer of the media section of Project 2025 was Brendan Carr, who is now the chairman of the FCC. So he is in a position of huge influence. And we've seen him, you know, figure out ways to dust off various FCC regulations and interpret them and try to implement them in ways that even folks on the right recognize are well out of bounds of what the original intent was. So, you know, I mean, he's a case study in why what we, you know, so much of what we see articulated in 2025 is dangerous, because he's running the FCC in a way that really has had zero respect for the well-established, you know, regulatory boundaries that the agency has. And so it's pretty frightening.
We'll come back to Trevor Carr in a moment, I promise. I want to come back to something you said earlier, Trevor, about people, freedom of the press mattering to everybody. The government always wants to control the message. They want their version of the story to be told. That's understandable, but a free press works to separate fact from fiction. So for people who are not journalists, who may like what they're watching coming out of the Trump administration in terms of his attempts to control the message, talk about what freedom of the press has meant to ordinary Americans over time in a country where so many people regard the Fourth Estate with deep suspicion. Why does it matter that we have a free press? It seems like a stupid question, but just for those who may agree with what's happening, answer it.
No, it's a great question. I mean, I think people who consider themselves conservative talk about how they want a small government, a non-corrupt government, a government that is not wasting money, a government that is not overreaching on the rights of Americans. And, you know, when you talk about it in these words, you know, I think anybody could agree with those statements. The problem is that the government also tries to keep everything that they do secret. Using the classification system, by rejecting public records requests, by refusing to talk to journalists, by punishing people who do talk to journalists. And you have to understand that no matter the administration, whether it's Barack Obama, Joe Biden, or Donald Trump, every single scandal that has been displayed to the American public has usually come to light because journalists have reported it. And that doesn't just mean journalists, the New York Times, the Washington Post. It could mean journalists who work at Fox News or the Washington Times or the Wall Street Journal. There is plenty of journalists on the right who use and are appreciative of press freedom rights. I mean, Barack Obama tried to call a Fox News reporter a co-conspirator in an Espionage Act case, which kind of set the stage for what Donald Trump is doing right now. You know, I think it's important for people on the right to understand that rights organizations are going after Donald Trump so hard right now, not just because of what he's doing to the specific people, but that we don't want this precedent to take hold forever, which allows any president to then crack down on the journalists that they don't like.
And we're witnessing increasing opaqueness by governments on almost every level. We certainly are witnessing it here in Charlotte, and we've talked about it many times on this program. It's often very difficult to get information out of our local government in a timely fashion. Reporters, Ida, have been allowed in this country to ask probing, uncomfortable, difficult questions to people in power and to hold that power to account. And we've been talking about how that's under attack in this country at the moment. So how does what we've been able to do and continue to be able to do, at least for the moment, compare to what you've experienced elsewhere?
I mean, one of the things I wrote in my end of year column this year is at the same time with all of these really depressing events happening with press freedom and to journalists, at the same time, I have so much admiration for the journalism being produced And I think a lot of journalists, despite everything, are doing really, really great work. Just recently, Laura Poitras put out a documentary on Seymour Hersh, and he's someone who his entire life was able to produce incredible reporting without having any access. And I think he's a model to follow and to look up to. And in Morocco, I mean, in a place I've been in many places where there's virtually no press freedom, and we still manage to get the word out, to get reporting out. And I don't want it all to be gloom and doom, but I think there is possibility to do excellent journalism despite it all. Not to say or to minimize what's been going on. What's been going on is really alarming, and it's been a terrible year in so many aspects. But at the same time, I think there's really journalists rising to the occasion and doing incredible work.
It's sometimes difficult to spot, and it's difficult to talk about because you don't know if you're right or wrong because it's happening in real time. And I'm talking about this apparent shift in this country toward autocracy, which is something I think that is outlined in Project 2025, and which the president certainly adheres to because he'd like to be. I think he said he's not a king, but he'd like to be a dictator for a day. And it's not just lack of freedom of the press or clamping down on the press. It's what we're witnessing happening in cities around this country, particularly recently in Minneapolis, where these masked federal agents are able to come into your home without a warrant and drag you out in your underwear. This is all part and parcel of that. And it's much more dramatic when we're seeing it unfold like that on television. But is this equally alarming, or perhaps should it be more alarming that he's trying to clamp down on people trying to uncover the truth of what we're witnessing? Ida.
Yes. No, it's definitely more alarming in many aspects. Again, I'm not trying to minimize, and I didn't want to sound like I was minimizing what's been happening, but I do think that what happens often with Trump is when it's Trump doing something, there's more attention. It feels bigger than it would if it were any other figure. I think Trevor went over a lot of past alarming precedents that were set before Trump and that we're seeing the consequences today. And I think Trevor wanted to add something.
Trevor?
Oh, well, first of all, I just wanted to second your recommendation of the Laura Poitras film about Seymour Hersh. If anybody's interested in watching it, it's on Netflix right now. It is just an incredible portrait of what a journalist should be. Essentially finding out stories that the government is trying to keep secret by all means necessary and informing the American public. But we've been talking a lot about journalism today. But when you read the First Amendment, like there, the freedom of the press clause is not for just full-time journalists. It's for everybody. And I think what we really need to keep in mind, especially with ICE agents in all of these cities across the country, is that everybody has the right to record public or government officials in public spaces. It's not just journalists. It's not just journalists in the New York Times or NPR or any of us. It is every single person in the United States. And those cell phone videos, number one, are holding ICE accountable and are informing the American public. And number two, they are very brave people who are doing it because, as we saw over the weekend with Alex Paretti, he may have lost his life in part because he was filming ICE agents and they were violating his rights. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that it's not just the full-time professional journalists that are afforded these rights or should be afforded these rights. It is every single one of us.
And that, I wanted to get to that because that to me is maybe indicative of the administration fighting a losing battle. But I do want to say this: people who are recording these incidents should have their phones set to back up their material to the cloud automatically, instantaneously, so that if the phone is seized or lost or damaged, that video still exists. We're watching the administration lie about what has happened in these two shooting deaths in Minneapolis, blatantly, provably lie, and tell you not to believe what these videos being taken by citizens are showing us. If press freedoms, Trevor, are reduced, is that a losing battle for the government? Because people are recording these things, and the recordings are getting out in a much more widespread way than they would just on traditional media.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, let's take the case of Alex Peretti. As I just mentioned, like his right to record was horribly violated in the absolute worst way, to the point where he was murdered by ICE agents. But we also have to remember that there was at least a half a dozen other people who were filming the same incident from different points of view. Those people, at least at that point, did not have their rights directly violated by ICE agents, were able to show the American public very quickly exactly what happened and caught the Trump administration in the most blatant lies that they have ever told. And that is a very high bar considering they lie every single day. And so, you know, the fact that it is somewhat ironic that the right to record was violated in such a horrific way, where at the same time that right to record is what has allowed us to see what unfolded. And so I would just remind everybody listening that that right is yours as an American citizen or non-citizen. If you are in the United States, you should have this right. And you should use it.
Philip.
Just to piggyback on this, for this kind of imagery, right, to have the you know, the real political effect that we expect, right, people need to see it and interpret it in the same way. And one of the things, as we watch, even for example, with what's happened with the Alex Peretti video, is we have to remember that for some folks, by the time they are seeing it, his phone has been AI replaced with a gun. Or we can think about sort of the liar's dividend, where when people see something that, you know, or you know, there's imagery out there that is contradictory, that they can say it's AI, or certainly people on the receiving end. If you look at folks who are deep down the rabbit hole and what they're saying on social media, they can convince themselves that any of this is AI. And then we're also seeing AI manipulations of the video circulate. So it's so frustrating. We can't lose sight of that fact that when this stuff goes into the ecosystem, there are plenty of us who see it and process it as the factual information that it is. And then there are other folks who are getting an entirely different version of this reality, either by choice or, inadvertently.
So much more to talk about. We're only going to scratch the surface about these attacks on freedom of the press, but we will attempt to do our best to continue to scratch that surface when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about freedom of the press with Ida Almey. She is the James Madison Visiting Professor on First Amendment Issues at the Columbia University School of Journalism. Philip Napoli, Professor of Public Policy and Director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. And Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Those of us who are old enough to remember the 1968 Democratic National Convention remember the riots in the streets of Chicago and the chant by the people in those demonstrations, "The whole world is watching." And they were, but not in real time. Today, the whole world watches in real time. We're watching what's happening in Minneapolis. We watched what happened in Chicago. We watched what happened in Charlotte. We're watching what's happening in Iran, Ida, through these videos being recorded by Iranian citizens and somehow getting them out of the country when the internet is available to transmit those images. But does it move the needle?
In which way?
In currying public favor in favor of the protesters and against regimes.
I think with Iran, it's very complicated because we have almost full internet shutdown. So it's really hard to get information from the ground. I know I've been in touch with people who were able to make it out and things like that, and it's extremely hard to build a narrative. And it's one of those stories where we really have to rely heavily on, and we have to be cautious about what we are hearing from the ground and not. And it's really hard to have journalists who are reporting remotely and telling the story of a place they're not. Where they're not physically, where very often they don't even speak the language, they have no sourcing or access. So I think I've had a lot of conversations with Iranians where they really are at loss about where to find information. And that's really scary because, on one hand, there's the regime in Iran that's not letting the information out. And at the same time, you have Western media who don't really know what's happening in the ground and kind of building a narrative. So it's a very complicated situation.
We have all these media companies in our ecosphere, Philip, who have bent the knee, paid off settlements to Donald Trump to either curry favor or to allow mergers and acquisitions to go through unimpeded. Can we really have a free press if corporations are in charge of all of our major operations and have to court favor with the government for their financial interests? Can we have a free press?
God, that is a tough question. We used to talk about, church-state separation, right? When we talked about the press and how, the advertising side would really maintain a genuine separation from, the reporting side. We've never come up with a similar sort of metaphor for what's happened as our journalistic institutions have become part of these larger corporate structures. We need that for us to genuinely have press freedom. We've had this struggle on the one, there was a point in time where, Jeff Bezos was looked at as the savior of the Washington Post, and we thought that that model of the billionaire philanthropist would be what would insulate journalism from political pressures. We know better now. So the track record there is not good for this sort of corporate conglomerate model of journalism giving democracy the journalism that it needs.
You wrote in that column I referenced earlier, Trevor, about former James Goodale, the former general manager of the New York Times, and he told you that the First Amendment is an economic issue at its core. It is for free expression, which touches on everything these conglomerates do, these conglomerates that have a news component to them. Ultimately, he says you can't have a media company or any company that doesn't have an ability to express itself freely. And as these companies bend the knee and pay these settlements, I'm wondering if they see it that way, or are they missing this somehow?
Yeah, another thing that Goodell said in that argument is that these mega conglomerates, if they don't want to defend the First Amendment, they should just get out of the news business entirely. But you're exactly right. Like, the First Amendment doesn't just cover news and news anchors and journalists. It covers any type of expression, whether we're talking about movies, whether we're talking about some commercials, a whole host of what these mega conglomerates do. And there was a time when these networks were leading the charge in sticking up for First Amendment rights. Like, we can go back to the Nixon era when the Pentagon Papers were happening, when the Nixon administration was acting much like the Trump administration, insulting the media, threatening to sue them, trying to censor them, and subpoenaing them. We had the CBS president testifying or refusing to testify in front of Congress when they subpoenaed him out there leading the charge. We had the news organizations banding together and figuring out how they were going to fight the Nixon administration. And it was, ABC and NBC and CBS somewhat leading the charge back then. And yet now what we see is the exact opposite, which is that these networks are the first to fold, and they're the first to not stand up for their own reporters' rights. And they're going to rue the day because we know that Donald Trump does not get placated when he is bribed through these settlements. So we've seen him threaten to sue CBS News multiple times already. even after this this settlement. And so what he does is, he's the classic bully. As soon as you give him something, he's going to want more.
The CBS, NBC, ABCs that you are referring to during the Nixon administration are very different companies than they are today. I think Frank Stanton is the president of CBS News, who
Yes,
refused to testify.
exactly.
And this is a time when these networks were just beginning to shift from being owned by people like William Paley at CBS and David Sarnoff at NBC, who viewed news as a responsibility, a civic responsibility, and not as a profit center. And now corporations own these news organizations, and they are primarily interested in profits at a time when confidence in mainstream media is declining, and when people get their news from their phones. They don't need CBS. They don't need NBC. Something that Barry Weiss made mention of yesterday in her leaked private meeting. Are we likely to see, if networks continue to act the way they have been acting in this environment, Trevor, are we likely to see what happened to newspapers happen to them, where these corporations come in, they buy the newspapers, they cut the staff, they cut the news coverage, they capitulate to pressure. Who wants to read them?
Yeah, in some ways it's a really good point, and the obviously the economics are changing fast. However, I would argue that these networks still are profitable and can be profitable for many years to come. Obviously, that is going to evolve and change as things come, and I think there are other smaller entities that could potentially own these networks, like the ones you were talking about back in the 70s. They were big companies. They weren't these giant 100 billion or trillion dollar conglomerates that only have a very, very tiny slice of their pie as news companies. But I think the other thing that we have to remember is when we talk about everybody getting their news off of TikTok or Facebook or name your social media company. Like what they are doing is they are consuming commentators or editorialists or people who are just informing. But when you look at the underlying information that those people are talking about, it all comes from mainstream news organizations. Like they are looking up at the camera and pointing at an excerpt from a newspaper article or an article from ABC News. And so even if people are consuming media on TikTok or Facebook the majority of the time, the news is originating at newspapers.
Ida, we're talking about the First Amendment, but the Constitution begins with the words "We the people," and it is the people that seem to be making a difference in Minneapolis. They are moving the needle, in part because of what they're seeing on CNN and NBC and ABC, CBS, etc., being covered. These demonstrations being covered. And we saw what happened with Jimmy Kimmel, who was pulled by ABC following a right-wing reaction to a monologue that included comments about Charlie Kirk's death. ABC's parent company, Disney, felt pressure from FCC Chairman Brendan Carr, who went so far as to say, "We can do this the easy way or the hard way," which was viewed by many as a licensing threat, something that Carr has denied. The public backlash, though, was enormous, and Kimmel was back on the air in the blink of an eye. It took viewers to move the needle, not the network, not its ownership, not some big conglomerate. How should we view that? Is that hope in the darkness?
I always see hope in the darkness. I do think there's power in numbers. There's power in people speaking up. Actually, I follow closely what Freedom of the Press puts out, and I one of the first thing I did was share with my students that you're allowed to film ICE agents. Like, remember this: your phone is such a powerful tool. Like, pull it out, film whatever you see. As I said, I grew up in a very repressive place in terms of press freedom, but we always managed to do it regardless. And we always manage to get the public informed regardless. And yes, there is power in letting the public know what's happening by any means necessary. And there is power in getting people informed and reacting to these things.
And Philip, freedom of the press, as Trevor has said many times in this program, doesn't just mean freedom for the New York Times or the Washington Post or network television. It means podcasters can have their say. They may not all be journalists or operating as journalists, and they may be coming from a particular slant, but they have become incredibly influential. On the left, we got people like Brian Tyler Cohen and David Pakman. On the right, we have Joe Rogan and Candace Owens and others. They've all taken the place of the most trusted man in America, Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley and Peter Jennings, as news sources. Why?
Well, I think importantly that, you know, that was the mechanism for reaching younger people. And so that, you know, reaching people that had previously, you know, or traditionally not been very politically engaged. Obviously, the mainstream media, the traditional media had lost, you know, I mean, the average age of a CBS News viewer is probably close to 70. And so, you know, the average age of a newspaper reader, probably very similar. So the podcast format became a way of capturing it. As we know, right, that was the real, the primary narrative that came out of the last election was the way Joe Rogan was able to politically mobilize young men who don't typically engage in politics much. So it was a way of sort of, you know, exerting some political influence that, you know, that could really genuinely move the needle. And so that's what podcasts are. Are really a better way of getting at folks who can become part of the politically mobilized who are not previously part of the politically mobilized.
And it will be hard to clamp down on them or control what they say or do. And we're watching the politics shift in large part with regard to what's going on with ICE because of Joe Rogan and others on the right looking at what they're seeing and saying they don't like it. Ida, you wrote that Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post, declared, quote, "Most people believe the media is biased and we must work harder to control what we can control to increase our credibility." But aren't those criticisms about the media being biased coming mostly from people and politicians on the right who are actively trying to reshape the world in their image and likeness and who are annoyed by anything that doesn't buy into that vision? And aren't many of those people now in charge of major corporations and newspapers and networks?
I think there are different arguments to that. I think since 2016, the first Trump presidency or the first Trump campaign, people started noticing this hyper focus on Trump in a way that turned a lot of people off. Not to say that he didn't deserve that kind of attention, but I think that started we started losing more and more people in that moment where it felt very hyper partisan. Where journalists were so upset when he was elected and then so upset again when he was elected last year. And I think we have to be careful about that. One of the things I've always tried to do in as a journalist in Morocco is be adversarial, no matter who is in charge, and kind of apply the same standards to everything. And I think you get a lot of respect from people who follow you when they see that you are adversarial regardless of political parties.
I don't have much time left, but I don't want to leave out something that has come back to haunt us. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr has mused recently about reviving the fairness doctrine so that it can be applied to late night and midday talk shows. The fairness doctrine went away in the Reagan administration because it was deemed not necessary anymore because other outlets had risen to broaden the scope of things. The fairness doctrine said that if you broadcast a particular side of an opinion on a particular side of an issue, you had to broadcast the other side. And what broadcasters did was they didn't do any of that. They just didn't have them on either side. When they got rid of the fairness doctrine, it gave rise to AM talk radio. It gave rise to other opinionated sources, which have changed the face of broadcasting. Trevor, if Carr follows through on this and is successful, Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Kimmel may have to alter their monologues or have the other side on their program. But in reality, wouldn't the same thing have to happen with partisan radio?
Yeah, I mean, I do want to point out just how ridiculous this is. Like, as you mentioned, the fairness doctrine was killed in the 80s. The people leading the charge were the right wing and the supporters of Ronald Reagan. If they didn't kill it themselves, it would have been killed by the right wing or the Supreme Court led by William Rehnquist. Like, they had already basically teed that up. And as you mentioned, like it has led to the rise of AM talk radio, which has been dominated by right-wing figures. And so, number one, I think this would be an affront to the First Amendment. But number two, I think the right wing would be shooting itself in the foot, because not only does this apply to networks on television, but it's going to apply to the radio as well. So careful what you wish for.
I was just going to say, be careful what you wish for. Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He joined us along with Philip Napoli, professor of public policy and director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University, and Ida Alami, James Madison visiting professor of the First Amendment issues at Columbia University School of Journalism. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.